Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello there, and a very warm welcome to the broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, the importance of passing on the faith. Subliminal art in a Michelangelo fresco depicting David and Goliath, and enhancing the bright side of things with Monsignor Peter Fleetwood. Thanks for joining me once again. Forgive me as I get ready to read you a list of names. Rome, Rio de Janeiro, Rome once again, Manila. If you've been counting that sequence, it sums up to four. Four venues then for an emblematic event held in these specific cities in the past decade. You may have guessed, it's a world meeting of families, beginning in 1994 under the pontificate of the late John Paul II, the man to invent these meetings and indeed to announce the venue and date of the fifth of them in a television message back in 2003. At the time, he announced the place, Valencia, Spain, and the date, July 2006. But while both the venue and date remain the same ones announced by him, the man to preside over this meeting, on the other hand, is his successor to the See of Peter, Benedict XVI. Once again, stepping into the shoes of his predecessor, he's getting ready to head to Valencia this weekend to preside over the closing of this fifth World Meeting of Families. Meetings which are designed to encourage adults to renew and deepen the faith at a time in history when, as we know, in many Western countries, the institution of marriage and the family has come under attack. And a few days ahead of Pope Benedict's travels, Susie Hodges thought she'd shine the spotlight on the state of the family in the world's biggest Western nation, the United States. In an effort to find out what the church is doing there to counteract such social trends. Stay tuned.
Never has the family been under attack so much as in our present-day society. It's a warning that has been repeated in different forms by Pope Benedict XVI in a number of key speeches devoted to the theme of families in recent months. Against a backdrop like this, it's clear that the Pope's decision to attend the World Meeting of Families in Valencia takes on added significance. Bishop Joseph Kurtz of Knoxville in Tennessee is the head of the U.S. Bishops' Committee on Marriage and the Family and is among the participants at the meeting in Valencia.
Well, I am delighted to know of our Holy Father's coming to Valencia, and it sends a clear message of the priority that our Holy Father brings to his pontificate of the gift of married love and the importance of the foundation of family, not only in our church, but really in all of civilization.
Do you think it's one of the key priorities of his pontificate?
I do. I think the fact that our Holy Father chose the theme of God is love as his first encyclical, and in fact speaks in that encyclical that the love of man and woman for each other in marriage is certainly the epitome, as he says in his encyclical, of love, speaks volumes to the priority that he gives to married love and to family in our world today.
Another member of the U.S. Bishops' Committee on Marriage and the Family is Archbishop Joseph Naumann of Kansas City. He agrees that defending and renewing the state of the family is a key priority for the Pope.
I think the Holy Father understands that the family is so central to everything. I mean, the family has been a great source of Christian evangelization as it passes the faith from one generation to the next. But it's also so important to culture and, I think, to society. And so, yes, I think the Holy Father sees this as a major priority.
The family has been described by Pope Benedict as a basic building block of our society. But in recent years, the prevailing culture in many Western countries has become less supportive of traditional marriage and the family. Archbishop Naumann again.
Well, I think it's not as strong as it was a generation ago, and primarily because I think there are many stresses within our culture on Christian marriage today and marriage in general. And also, in recent years, have had this attempt to redefine marriage, which again is the foundation of the family, and whenever you jeopardize that foundation, you weaken the family. So I think we have many strong, vibrant families. However, I don't think our culture is as supportive today as of families generation ago.
Bishop Kurtz says the family faces a number of key challenges coming from different quarters.
I believe that the attacks, if you will, on marriage come from many fronts. Certainly, there is that strong movement of secularism. However, I think on an individual basis, social scientists are pointing out in the United States that couples still desire a permanent marriage. The difficulty is, of course, their will to make that commitment and that desire real. Many of the supports in the past have been gone to support the permanence of marriage, the closeness of family, of community. And so there is a great need for us as a church to provide those supports to families because their heart still desires in many ways that permanence of marriage. The author George Weigel, in his book A Letter to Catholics, mentions that what competes with the permanence of marriage is the mantra, keep the options open, which of course affects greatly where people work and where they live. And so it's tempting for people to apply that mantra of keep the options open to the intimate commitment of married love.
But although most people still believe in the concept that marriage is for keeps, why are so many couples failing to stay together? And what can the church do to help them?
We have, I would say, three themes that characterize really the opportunity for a great movement and momentum swing with marriage in the United States. First of all, there is the obvious ambivalence among people. Over the last 30 years, the rates of divorce and the rates, unfortunately, of people who choose to live together without the permanent commitment of marriage have grown. However, in these same people, as I mentioned earlier, there still is that desire for a permanent union that I believe there's an ambivalence in people that we as a church can capture and work with. One of the reasons we can is that the social scientists are now speaking in great volume of the effects of divorce and people who choose to live together before marriage on the quality of the lives of the couples, as well as, obviously, on the life of the children who are often part of that union. And this becomes, I think, a stage, if you will, for the church's bold and refreshing teaching on the permanence of marriage to have a day. So I actually feel a great optimism, even in the midst of all the challenges that have been well documented.
Rates of divorce have risen significantly in most major Western countries in recent decades. But Bishop Kurtz says there are some grounds for hope amidst all the gloomy statistics.
Well, actually, the rates of divorce, or what some of the social scientists call the risk of divorce, which is the projection of how likely a divorce is for someone marrying today, have gone up and down. They have, thank God, in the last couple of years, been somewhat stable. One of the things that is the good news is the fact that couples who are better educated are often able to have a will to live together in marriage in a permanent way. And so the divorce risk is now, in some cases, dropping in certain segments of the population in the United States. The reason, of course, I think that divorce has risen is multiple. A primary one is the fact that in our culture, as I said, there is a great sense of people feeling that they want to keep their options open. One of the most discouraging aspects that needs to be turned around is the fact that people who choose to live together before they enter into a permanent vow of marriage tend to have, unfortunately, a greater risk of having a divorce in their life.
One of the more recent threats facing the family are moves to legalize same-sex unions in several Western nations. Bishop Kurtz and Archbishop Naumann are both understandably worried about this new trend.
Yes, the Church, and I particularly am very concerned about this movement to legalize and give status to same-sex unions. And I believe that the majority of the people agree with me on this. When there is a state referendum for the issue of protecting marriage as defined as a union of one man and one woman, in virtually all the states, people speak sometimes at the level of 70 or 80% in favor of the traditional definition of the God-given definition of marriage. It is true that one state has not done that. However, I believe the biggest problem that we have now are very small but very active lobby efforts, and also, unfortunately, judicial systems in which a very small group of judges can make significant decisions that actually go beyond the will of the people.
Certainly, I'm very concerned about it in the United States. Now, here, where the people have had an opportunity to vote on it, there's been overwhelming support for marriage understood as it has been traditionally through culture and for millennia as between a man and a woman. And these referendums on state constitutional amendments are usually passed by 70% or more of the vote. But what the fear here is that, like abortion, that the court will intervene. And that's what's happened in Massachusetts. And that's what we're afraid that our Supreme Court could do. And like abortion, really take away the ability of states to regulate what the understanding of marriage is. So that's a particular fear here in the United States. And there's been a real effort that we hope someday will be realized to put in a federal constitutional amendment that would protect marriages between a man and a woman.
Given all these worrying social trends, Archbishop Naumann says there is no room for complacency, and all the church must mobilize to defend the traditional form of marriage and the family.
We can't take for granted marriage and family life, and so I think those of us who understand and appreciate their importance, that we must do everything we can. First of all, to help married couples to know how important their vocation is. Oh, it truly is that. It's a call from God to love each other, together, be co-creators with Him of new human life. But there's nothing more beautiful or more worthwhile to give one's life than to be a husband and a father, a wife and a mother. And that these are wonderful vocations that I think, again, people sometimes in our culture, they get so attracted to other ways that can be good ways that they can contribute to society, but they fail to see that if we don't have strong families, our culture and the very fabric of our society collapses.
Why do you think that in some ways the church's message is being, if not drowned out, but at least rather overlooked by so many people? Why is it so difficult to get its message across in today's society?
Well, here in the United States, if you look at our secular media, at the movies and television shows, there are so few positive presentations of marriage and family life. And I think that this has had an effect over time. The negative messages that are so often part of our popular cultural mass communication. So I think this is what in many ways is forming people. The church, I believe we have to try in our own way to use these same methods of communication, but use them in a very constructive way to support marriage and family life. But I think it's really a culture war in some sense, and part of the reason why church's message is being overwhelmed is because of what we find in our mass media today.
Turning to Bishop Kurtz, what does he believe is the biggest single threat facing the family today?
I believe that the greatest threat to marriage and family in the United States is an improper understanding of freedom. I believe that our church rightly speaks of freedom as the true opportunity to embrace God's plan in our lives, what has been called very beautifully a freedom for excellence. Unfortunately, I think freedom in our secular culture often is simply a freedom to say no. And one effect of this movement of such freedom is the willingness to give up on a marriage commitment at the first sign of difficulty.
So, ultimately, where does the institution of marriage and the family stand? And what does its future look like in our increasingly secularized world? Bishop Kurtz again.
It is very difficult to read the future. And, of course, there are enough attacks and elements within our society that speak against marriage. However, a Christian hope that is based on Jesus in his power leading us always has us, with both eyes wide open, look to the future and see signs of hope in our own culture. And I continue to be optimistic. However, I know that we need to say yes to God's grace. I believe that in the United States, the pastoral initiative that the bishops of the United States have taken on marriage is a 3-year opportunity for us to renew our will to assist families and especially assist young people who are of marrying age to choose the right alternatives, embracing a vocation of marriage in their life.
Well, thanks there to Bishop Joseph Kurtz of Knoxville in Tennessee, the head of the U.S. Bishops' Committee on Marriage and the Family, and to Archbishop Joseph Naumann of Kansas City, also member of this same committee. Thanks, too, to my colleague Susie Hodges. Meanwhile, time to change the tone and go arty, joining our Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Ennis, standing by for a virtual tour of a particular fresco high on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. So, Breda, we're going to speak about David and Goliath.
Yes.
In one of the spandrels of the Sistine Chapel.
Yes.
It's obviously by Michelangelo.
It's up above the entrance to the Sistine Chapel. So these are the two scenes that you see up in the two corners, like almost holding the ceiling together, stopping it from falling into the chapel. You always get this sense when you look at these triangles, the four of them holding up all of the work on the top, at each end, at the four corners of the Sistine Chapel. So David and Goliath is one of the two that you can see as you enter. On the right-hand side you have David and Goliath, and the other side you have Judith. But we're going to talk here about David and Goliath. But they do have one thing in common, that they are a kind of a moral warning to those entering the chapel. So both, with their humility and wisdom and strength, serve the function of warning those of what can happen if the law of God is not observed. So there's a sort of prophetic sense here, and also the salvation of man coming through the Messiah because of the inhuman feats that they performed. Now, going back to David and Goliath, you have the war between the Philistines and the Israelites, and Goliath is looking for somebody to challenge him. The giant Goliath is looking for someone to challenge him in a duel. And of course, nobody wants to do this. So little David decides he's going to be brave and comes forward and manages to kill the giant. It's a strange scene. It's almost abstract in a way, because at the bottom part you see what could be a rock, brownish coloured rock, or certainly is the earth. You have the giant lying literally right across scene, gigantic, obviously. And David is right above him in the act. He's in the act of cutting off his head, but he hasn't yet done so. So it's interesting, he grabs the giant by the hair. You can see his hand going into the hair and pulling at it, just to keep him under control. The giant is dressed in green, and the sleeves of his garment are a sort of an orange and white stripe. It's a very strange combination of colours there, actually. But I think it also helps to give more power to the scene, because those stripes, those little orange stripes you can see in the tent also behind David. So there are certain links there. Your eye goes up one line and goes through David and goes into another line behind him. Now, the giant is falling down. David is dressed in blue and a green, which is like, it's a kind of gauge green in a sense, and very delicate green, whereas the colours worn by the giant are rougher, less finished colours, let's say. Then behind the two figures, you have this extraordinary tent, which is obviously the kind of tent you would have on normal battlefields anyway. But Michelangelo has painted it in such a way that it gives a kind of breath to the scene. It gives David a beautiful background because the tent, the bottom part of the tent is white and it curves around and it goes into, it's going into another triangle. It's almost like the tent itself will become a triangle. Even though you can't see the top of the tent, which is outside the painting, let's say. And then you can see the orange part on the top with the lines, and you can get the feeling that there's a light inside the tent. So this is all helping to illuminate David in the moment when he is about to cut the head off the giant. Now, hidden in the back, on each side, behind the ground or rock or whatever, are the soldiers who are looking on in disbelief and horror. That how can this possibly be happening? So they're absolutely amazed. Michelangelo manages to do a lot of this work without doing too much detail. It's extraordinary the way you have, for example, the face of David has a lot of detail. And you can really see his expression and his concentration. His clothes are also very detailed. The giant, you can't see his face, but his hair is very detailed and the light is falling on his head. So that means that anybody looking at this piece from the ground will see that David is grabbing his hair. So you don't have any doubt as to what's happening there. Then Michelangelo has painted one of the hands of the giant, almost like it's just like an abstract piece, just a shape. But it's not a detailed hand. The other hand is very detailed. And again, you look at the feet of the giant, the one foot that you can actually see. Again, it's very chunky and not particularly detailed either. The soldiers, the ones on the right-hand side, are very clearly defined. The ones on the left, not so. You get the feeling that the scene goes around inside. He has been able to create a sense of space that you can imagine the space that's beyond the space that he's painting in. The whole story of this, obviously, is the triumph of good over evil. Which obviously is the entire message of the Sistine Chapel. It's the entire message of the Old and New Testament. This is where Michelangelo is able to let us in to his way of explaining the theology of the body through his attempts at trying to express with visual figure God's message to us.
Thank you there to Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Ennis of the American University of Rome, for sharing with us her expertise in the field of sacred art. Finally, before we end on a more reflective note, let's join Monsignor Peter Fleetwood.
A woman I know telephoned recently to say she's expecting her second baby. I've learned from long experience not to jump for joy, at least not immediately, because sometimes it is not welcome news. So I said, "Are you happy?" The reply was silence. Then, well, I wasn't at first. I was surprised and thought, "I can't be pregnant, but I'm getting used to it now." I was relieved to hear that, because sometimes the tone in a woman's voice is not just surprise, but anger or desperation. The circumstances can be so difficult that it can seem unbearable to think that the next few months will be the usual complications of a pregnancy, and that you're landed with a child at the end of it all. It isn't always a source of joy. I remember another friend whom I've not seen for years. She used to be a religious sister. After a few years, she left, and I lost track of her. I heard she had had a baby, so went to see her and her little boy. She told me the story. Her family had basically told her to go when she left the convent, so she was quite alone. She met a man, and they decided to get married. She was not prepared to live with him until they were married, but that didn't stop her getting pregnant. A peculiar thing happened just a few days before they were due to get married. He asked if he could move in now that they were almost married. When she said no, he turned around and walked out of her life. No more wedding. My poor friend went into a deep depression. She was totally lost and panic-stricken. She was so disorientated, she thought she could never manage with a child. What's the point? Why bother having the child? I'm so useless, nobody loves me, and I won't be able to cope. But another strange thing happened. My friend was a nurse and had a visit from the Catholic chaplain to the hospital. He did what I've learned not to do and said, "I hear you're having a baby. That's beautiful. I'm really delighted for you." She burst into tears, but she was not angry or upset, just full of joy. He had said exactly what she needed to hear. He gave her a lot of help, and she eventually settled down to life with her little boy. She even managed to get a job, which allowed her plenty of time to look after him. Her family was still not pleased with her, so she moved away from our town and began a new life. The last time I spoke to her, she was married to a good man who was really looking after her. Sadly, the priest who was so good to her was hounded out of his parish by accusations from a particular family, and he went to work in another diocese. He is a good and kind man, but he has had to leave his home and his family because of small-mindedness. He too must have asked, "Why bother?" but for very different reasons. Another woman I know became pregnant to a man to whom she was not married. I know who the man is, but have never met him. The irony was that she had decided while chatting to me one day to finish the relationship. The day after she told him, she discovered she was pregnant. "Oh no, I can't be." The news hit her like a sledgehammer. What a disaster. No money, no man, no support. As usual in Britain, the first advice she was given was to terminate the pregnancy. She was furious with the doctor at the very idea of destroying a life. And despite all the odds, she was convinced this child was worth the bother. In fact, she has a lovely child. She does have a hard time paying the bills, but her family and some of her friends do a lot to help her when she lets them. She's a proud woman. When I hear the story of an angel asking a girl to be the mother of God, I'm always reminded of my various friends who've been in such messy situations, and I'm proud of them all, because these days the temptation more and more is to say, "Why bother?" They've never quite said Mary's words, "Be it done unto me according to thy word," but they still remind me of her. She and they might all have said no.
You've been listening there to what seems to me a moving reflection by Monsignor Peter Fleetwood. And that brings us up to time. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick.
Laudator Jesus Christus.